This is Prevention Magazine. I'll be reading articles for the January 19th, 2021 episode of Prevention Magazine. The first article is Editor's Note, Personal Questions by Sarah Smith. Personal questions. I'm going to ask you two things. I would never bring it up if we met in real life. How old are you, and how do you feel about your weight? Go ahead and answer silently to yourself. But my guess is that your first answer may have something to do with your second. That's why we created Lose Weight at Any Age, a guide to what your body needs as you get older in order to stay healthy. And yes, drop pounds. We know a healthy weight is important for so many reasons. To keep your heart and brain in good shape, for starters. And sure, there are some universal truths about getting there. But let's be honest. Aging changes the body. So we've looked at what happens over time to give you the best strategies depending on where you are in life. What we're not saying is that aging is a problem. Aging is a fascinating thing worth understanding. And if you don't dread it, that actually works to help you live longer, according to our myth-busting story. I love when things work out like that. For another way to embrace your age, check out our story about going gray. Finally, one more question I wouldn't ask in person. Have you ever had a puzzling health issue, but then finally received a diagnosis that helped you get better? We're launching a new regular column, My Diagnosis, and we'd love to hear your story so that they can help other people find relief too. Email letters at prevention.com if you want to share. That was Personal Questions by Sarah Smith. The next article is Lose Weight at Any Age by Tiffany Ezenwa Onyejiaka. Maintaining a healthy weight can help you sleep better, optimize energy, support joints, and lower risk of chronic conditions. Try these expert-backed strategies to lighten up, no matter how many candles are on your cake. Are your pants tighter even though you haven't changed your eating habits? Does it feel as if walks and virtual Zumba workouts are doing great things for your health, but not necessarily for the appearance of your thighs? It's probably not all in your head. Let's not sugarcoat it. Each decade brings new obstacles to losing weight. Our bodies become more resistant to change, while busy lives make it easy to put our well-being on the back burner. Carrying a few extra pounds isn't a big deal. It may even help you live longer. But being really overweight is linked to serious problems including heart disease and cancer. So it's smart to keep your weight within a normal range. Here's what you need to know about how the body changes, plus the best strategies for healthy weight loss no matter what your age. In your 30s, the big slowdown. From unexplainable aches to random gray hairs, your 30s can make you feel as if your body is turning into your mom's. Add to that the puffiness that doesn't seem to go away like it used to, even if you go easy on the wine and cheese for a bit. The major reason weight gets stickier in our 30s. Metabolism becomes less efficient with every revolution of the earth around the sun. As we get older, our muscle mass decreases, which works to slow down our metabolism, says Karen E. Gibbs, MD, a bariatric surgeon at Staten Island University Hospital in New York City. If you have less muscle, you're burning fewer calories. New moms have it especially hard. Beyond getting less sleep or having their sleep interrupted, they're dealing with metabolism that holds on to the baby weight long after their babies have made their debut. During pregnancy, the body requires more calories, and as a result, metabolism increases, says Nicholas Assange, MD, an assistant professor of medicine at Howard Medicine in Washington, D.C. It goes back to normal after delivery and breastfeeding, which can make it hard for moms to lose pounds as if they don't have enough to worry about. Getting back into the jeans you wore in college shouldn't be your goal. You've got enough on your plate. But making an effort to live more healthily can boost your overall well-being and give you more energy to power through each day. Your action plan. Balance your plate. Focus on eating a variety of foods from all food groups, including dairy and whole grains, says Sarah Wing, RD of Waitsfield, Vermont, past president of the Vermont Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. As tempting as Big Premise diets are, eliminating whole food groups makes it more difficult to have a balanced diet and getting all the nutrients vital for good health as we age. Wing says the only eating changes that can lead to sustainable weight loss are ones you can live with over time, she adds. So crash diets are useless for healthy long-term weight management. Use your time wisely. Super busy people juggling kids and work need their whole family on board. Figure out healthy meals that work for everyone to eat together, suggests Elise Mousselis, a certified eating psychology and nutrition expert. That way you won't have to make separate child-friendly meals, and if you model healthy eating behaviors, that can inspire your kiddos to eat better. Do-it-yourself tacos or baked potatoes with toppings are always a hit with kids. To make breakfast more fun, Wing suggests baking scrambled eggs in a muffin tin packed with veggies and herbs and adding a sprinkle of cheddar. On really crazy work days, plan time for eating nutritious meals just as you would schedule an important meeting. Mousselis recommends, while you're at it, set aside time at the beginning of the week to organize ingredients so you can toss together healthy meals in a jiffy. Consider a wellness practitioner. If eating well is hard to pull off alone, that's okay. Some things require guidance. Check in with an expert to figure out which healthy habits you've gotten down pat and which could use some improvement. Call your health insurance company to find an in-network wellness provider, or look for a member of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics at eatright.org. An expert can assess your relationship with food and pinpoint why you eat the way you do so you can address issues and kick bad habits, says Mousselis. Were lots of sweets or big portions a part of your childhood such that they now remind you of happy times? Is binging the way you de-stress? Or do you need to learn to cook veggies that taste good? The answers will help you get on the best track. In your 40s, a hormonal roller coaster. Though you're an adult, your 40s can hand you haywire hormones reminiscent of your teenage years. Women experience fluctuations and a decrease in estrogen, which encourage extra pounds to be deposited around the belly, Dr. Kibb says. This starts earlier than you might think. Estrogen levels start to go up and down rapidly during perimenopause, the time before menopause, usually when a woman is in her 40s. A study in Exercise and Sports Sciences Review found that low estrogen was associated with weight gain and metabolic dysfunction, which can put you at risk for conditions such as type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Your thyroid might also throw a wrench in your weight loss plans right now. Thyroxine T4 is a hormone governing the thyroid gland. Low levels of it can indicate hypothyroidism, often diagnosed in women in their 40s, says Dr. Zinge, adding that T4 and triiodothyronine, T3, help regulate metabolism and energy use. Diagnosis of several other health problems, in addition to existing hypothyroidism, prompted Naja Young, 47, a professor and filmmaker in Atlanta, to make changes 3 years ago. I was at a place where I felt very unhealthy, and I was told by my doctor that I was pre-diabetic, she says. She started a low-carb diet, then transitioned into ketogenic and intermittent fasting. She lost approximately 85 pounds over the following 2 years. Your action plan. Have your hormones checked. Ask for a physician to test your hormone levels to make sure imbalances are not sabotaging your weight loss efforts. Because Young had prediabetes and hypothyroidism, she had blood work done every 6 weeks to monitor her blood sugar and thyroid hormone levels. Your doctor may also suggest other tactics, like managing stress, limiting processed and high sugar foods to help rebalance hormones. Avoid extremes. You likely didn't gain weight in a few weeks, so don't make a drastic change in an attempt to lose all that quickly. One of the first things I did was commit to exercising for 30 minutes at least 3 days a week, Young says. She also increased her daily water intake. Even if you don't see the number on your scale move right away, remind yourself that you're doing this for better health in the long run. Once you hit a goal, you can set your sights higher. Slow down at meals. Many of us eat too fast and barely taste our food. A slow approach allows one to listen to internal cues of feeling satisfied and may result in consuming fewer calories, says Wing. Research also shows that eating without distractions can help you eat less. Whether you're having a feast or a small snack, set your phone on Do Not Disturb, store out of view, and sit, don't stand. Wing also suggests putting your fork down and taking sips of water between bites. Pay attention to smells, tastes, and textures of every bite, too. Not only will this focus your attention and build some natural pauses into your meal, but it also might help combat stress. When you're stressed, you're not going to digest your food as well and absorb the nutrients, says Musiles. Your stress response takes your metabolism offline. She adds that taking a few deep breaths before a meal can calm nerves and relax your body, putting you in an ideal state to digest and take nutrients from your food. In your 50s, chronic conditions versus weight loss. This is when long-term physical issues pop up seemingly out of nowhere. 78% of adults age 55 and older have at least one, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Many chronic conditions, such as diabetes, can interfere with weight loss directly. Others, like high blood pressure, are often treated with medications that can lead to weight gain. Adopting healthier habits can lower your risk of developing a chronic condition, help you manage existing one, and promote weight loss. I knew the excess pounds I had accumulated in my 40s, in combination with a sedentary lifestyle and the stress of a separation and divorce, could lead to a heart attack or a stroke, says Jamie Gold, 60, of San Diego, who is a Mayo Clinic certified wellness coach and the author of Wellness by Design. The end of her marriage propelled her to eat better and exercise more. Over 3 years, Gold was able to drop about 100 pounds. Your action plan. See your doctor. If you have a chronic condition, ask your physician whether it might hinder your weight loss efforts directly or indirectly, and find out what you can do to counteract potential problems, perhaps through switching meds or modifying behaviors. At your annual physical, ask if any of your supplements or meds might be holding your weight loss back and what you can do to be sure your health stays on track. Find a new type of exercise. Hike a nearby trail or take a stand-up paddle boarding class. When we finally find a fitness routine that works for us, it can be difficult to switch things up. But there are many proven benefits to trying new routines, says Kevin Robinson, DPT, DS, a physical therapist at the Nashville-based Performance Therapy Institute. Along with fighting exercise boredom, you can build a new muscle, prevent overuse injuries, and increase your chances of weight loss. Gold added swimming to her routine, and she has participated in running races as well. Get a group behind you. Dees Dye, 59, a Tyson Foods employee in Oneota, Alabama, recently had an epiphany about her health. I weighed the most I ever had, she recalls. The muffin top and everything started, and I was getting really depressed about it. Dye joined 99 Walks, $16 per month, an online community revolving around walking programs for women to help with weight loss. She has dropped 21 pounds so far and credits her success to having a support system of others working toward a similar goal. In your 60s and beyond, everything adds up. But now you've learned a lot about taking care of yourself, but lifelong habits can catch up with you. For instance, decades of yo-yo dieting can culminate in metabolic damage that makes it hard to drop pounds. And exercise can become downright painful, as arthritis, diagnosed in 50% of people 65 and older, kicks in. In addition, it takes longer to fall asleep as people reach 60, according to a 2017 study in sleep medicine clinics. A vicious cycle tends to ensue here. A lack of sleep can undermine weight loss efforts, and being overweight can keep you from sleeping well. Your action plan. Do joint-friendly exercises. I recommend low-impact strength training exercise to maintain and build muscle mass and improve joint stability, says Robinson. Strength exercises also help with bone density so you can avoid the scourge of osteoporosis, he says. Water aerobics is ideal for those living with arthritis and other forms of joint pain, says DeBlair Tate, an Atlanta-based certified fitness trainer and owner of fitness apparel brand 8 Figured. don't shrug off shut-eye. Between night sweats and intermittent random awakenings, postmenopausal women are at a disadvantage. If you experience sleep disruption, reach out to a specialist for suggestions, and try to keep a regular sleep schedule in which you avoid large meals and electronics for 2 to 3 hours before going to bed. Thank your body. It doesn't look and work the way it did in your 20s, but it's not supposed to. Over the years, your body let you do many things you loved, perhaps dancing at weddings, playing with your pets, or hugging your grandkids. Use that as motivations to stay active and nourish yourself with healthy foods. Look up some affirmations to tell yourself every morning, or jot down your feelings in a journal, suggests Mimi Secor, DNP, a Massachusetts-based family nurse practitioner who successfully lost 30 pounds at the age of 60. Even if you don't see the number on the scale you used to see, you can be proud of what you're doing for your body. That article was Lose Weight at Any Age by Tiffany Ezinwa Oyenjiaka. The next article is 5 Myths About Longevity by Kate Rockwood. Clearly, the fountain of youth is a fantasy, but that's not the only fiction out there about living long and strong. Myth 1. A sunny, optimistic disposition increases your lifespan. Myth Buster. An upbeat personality won't help you in the long life sweepstakes. A Longevity Project study followed more than 1,500 people for 80 years found out that the cheery, happy-go-lucky folks actually live shorter lives. The ones who live longest, persistent and prudent types. The lighthearted ones, based on everything will turn out fine philosophy, tended to take more risk with their health, such as skipping recommended screenings as they aged. That's not to say you need to be dour or worried to tack on more years of life. Laughter actually is good medicine. One study found that older adults who laughed every day had lower rates of heart disease and stroke. Just try to balance life enjoyment with a serious approach to maintaining your health. Myth 2. Working too hard will put you in an early grave. Myth Buster. Hard workers actually have a 20% to 30% lower risk of early death, according to the Longevity Project study. If your workplace causes you to take home stress, that's bad for your health. But for most, the social engagement and mental stimulation of working bring real benefits. One study found that healthy people who worked a year longer before retiring had an 11% lower risk of dying during the 18-year study period. But it's not being paid so much as having a sense of purpose that helps extend longevity, says study in Psychological Science. You can find purpose in just about any type of activity, from volunteering to helping care for a grandchild to taking up a social hobby. It's about the importance of community and being in service to others, says Katherine Johnson, MD, founder and medical director of Precision Medical Care in Clarendon Hills, Illinois. Myth 3. If people in your family tend to die young, you will too. Myth Buster. Genetics account for only a small percentage of your longevity. Sure, your DNA matters if you have at least one parent who lives past the age of 70. Your chances of living longer go up. But lifestyle habits and your environment, both of which impact how your DNA is expressed, play a much bigger role, says Dr. Johnson. When researchers studied more than 123,000 people, they found that 5 lifestyle habits in particular, maintaining a healthy weight, never smoking, exercising, following a healthy diet, and drinking only in moderation, greatly increased life expectancy at age 50. Quality health care and access to clean air and water play a role too, says Dr. Fine, MD, medical director of the Princeton Longevity Center. Still, talk to your doc about your family history, which can indicate greater risk for genetically linked diseases, so you can take advantage of health screenings and find ways to lower those risks, Dr. Fine says. Myth 4. Aging is the worst. Myth Buster. No doubt some aspects of aging are suboptimal, ahem, the neck waddle, but it's far from all bad, and people who embrace aging live 7.5 years longer on average than those who dread it. This may be in part because people have a bleaker outlook on getting older or less proactive about seeking health care when issues pop up. They may simply ascribe them to aging and fail to address them, a study found. So if you think every stiff joint or energy dip is because you're not as young as you used to be, it's worth talking things through with your doctor. Just one example. It's true that our immune system response weakens over time, which can leave the body in a chronic state of inflammation. And that's linked to heart disease and some cancers. But by eating less sugar, exercising more, spending more time outside, managing your stress, and consuming foods rich in omega-3 fatty acids, you can dial inflammation way down, says Dr. Johnson. I used to tell my patients, oh, that's just what happens when you get older. But I've stopped saying that, she says. I believe we can manage how our bodies age. Myth 5. It's too late to do anything good by giving up bad habits like smoking and tanning. Myth buster. It's never too late to improve your health and even increase your lifespan. Take smoking. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that people who stopped smoking when they were between ages 45 and 54 gained about 6 years of life compared with others who kept puffing. The same goes for resigning from the Couch Potato Club. A BMJ study found that physically active helped people live longer, even if they hadn't exercised before. And if you've been lax about slathering on sunscreen, researchers showed in a four-year study at the University of Queensland that daily sunscreen use slowed skin aging even in middle age. You might not be able to fully erase damage done by a history of unhealthy habits, but making a change is always worthwhile, Dr. Johnson says. That article was 5 Myths About Longevity by Kate Rockwood. The next article is Insights, Immunotherapy for Cancer by Beth Howard. For decades, the most effective treatments for cancer have involved surgery and rounds of chemotherapy or radiation. But some of those treatments can harm healthy cells, which is why advancements in the harness of the power of the immune system are a big deal. Some patients have truly remarkable responses to immunotherapy that last for years. In some cases, so many years that we think these patients may even be cured of their disease, says Ezra Cohen, MD, co-director of the Precision Immunotherapy Clinic at UC San Diego Health. This therapy doesn't work for every cancer yet, but here's the latest. Training the body to fight back. Normally, the immune system attacks anything foreign to the body, such as viruses and bacteria. But because cancer starts in non-cancerous cells, the immune system doesn't always see it as dangerous. The goal of immunotherapy is to teach the immune system to recognize and kill cancer cells, says Ong Nang, MD, a professor of investigational cancer therapeutics at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. The most common type of immunotherapy for cancer involves checkpoint inhibitors, drugs that take the brakes off an immune response that's already underway, unleashing its full power. With chimeric antigen receptor, CAR, T-cell therapy, doctors take T-cells from a patient's blood, engineer them to target the tumor, and return them to the patient to attack the cancer. Scientists are also developing vaccines, not just ones that prevent cancer like the HPV vaccine, but also ones that boost immune response. And to ramp up the assault on cancer, they're creating monoclonal antibodies, versions of the body's own disease-fighting antibodies in the lab. Treating more cancers. So far, it's patients with several hard-to-treat cancers, including melanoma, head and neck cancers, and kidney, bladder, and non-small cell lung cancer, who have benefited most from immunotherapy. These types of tumors are considered hot, because the immune cells in them can be activated, Dr. Nane says. They respond well to immunotherapy. Other cancer types such as colon and pancreatic cancer and most breast cancers are considered severely immunosuppressive or cold, but researchers are starting to see success by combining immuno-other therapy with traditional treatments. The FDA recently approved the first immunotherapy for breast cancer after a checkpoint inhibitor called atezolizumab, combined with chemotherapy, was shown to have significant effects. It's now the first-line treatment for some women with breast cancer tumors that are triple-negative, an aggressive and particularly deadly form of the disease. A monoclonal antibody called the pembrolizumab was also approved along with chemotherapy for certain types of early-stage triple-negative breast cancers. What's coming up? Researchers are trying to understand why immunotherapy agents work for only about 20% of cancer patients and why some patients experience life-threatening complications while others have almost no side effects. Meanwhile, the race to develop more treatment goes on. Immunotherapies have been approved for 20 different cancers at last count, says Dr. Cohen. This is signaling a new era of cancer therapy. That article was Insights, Immunotherapy for Cancer by Beth Howard. The next article is Pulse, Spice Things Up. For your heart, new research says regularly eating hot chili peppers is associated with a reduced risk of dying from all causes, including heart disease and cancer. The findings presented at a recent American Heart Association conference reflect a meta-analysis of four large studies involving more than 570,000 people. Scientists had previously found that chili peppers have an anti-inflammatory properties thanks to capsaicin, the compound that gives them their hot, spicy taste. More studies are needed to figure out whether the benefit depends on the type of hot pepper you eat and how much of you chow down on. But for now, it can't hurt to add a little spice to your diet. Why not take advantage of the cooler weather and whip up a big pot of chili with a kick? That article was Pulse, Spice Things Up. The next article is Pulse, Fighting Cancer with Exercise. Encouraging cancer news. A new study of mice in the journal eLife found that exercise made T cells, white blood cells essential to immunity, better at attacking cancerous cells. Researchers said the findings shed light on how our lifestyles affect the immune system, and they hope their work may lead to new immunotherapy and treatments for the disease. If you or a loved one is battling cancer, talk to your doctor about exercise and which activities or routines are safe to try. That article was Pulse, Fighting Cancer with Exercise. That concludes today's reading for January 19th, 2021's episode of Prevention Magazine. This has been Herbert Gilmore for Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
AARP Foundation Tax Aid is looking to expand its team of volunteers for the upcoming tax season. Tax Aid, celebrating its 52nd year, offers free in-person preparation and assistance to anyone, especially those 50 and older, who can't afford a tax preparation service. Volunteers make a difference in their communities by assisting many older, lower-income taxpayers and their families who might otherwise miss out on the tax credits and deductions they've earned. Every level of experience is welcome. Volunteer tax preparers complete tax preparation training and IRS certification. The program is offered at senior centers in Odessa and Midland. Local information and details can be obtained by contacting Bob Schuler, District Coordinator at 432-362-7204.
Now airing on the Noon Book Hour, we go to our Western shelf to select one of Elmer Kelton's earliest books, Buffalo Wagons. For Gage Jameson, the summer of 1873 has been a poor hunt. A year ago, he felled 62 buffalo in one stand, but now the great Arkansas River herd is gone. In Dodge City, old hide hunters speak in awe of a last great herd to the south. But no hunter who values his scalp dares ride south of the Cimarron and into Comanche territory. None but Gage Jameson. Jameson heads for Texas when the buffalo herds are wiped out in the north, knowing the gamble and dangers that confront him and willing to risk the threat of Comanches. What he does not know is that Ransom King, who has saved his life, will turn against him, that he will have to rescue a white woman captured by the Indians, and that failure and death are near neighbors. Buffalo Wagons by Elmer Kelton. Weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 41 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome, this is Able Living, and I'm your reader, Kevin, with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Disability Scoop, and now I'll begin with Feds Say Institution Experimented on Residents with Intellectual Disabilities. This article written by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, and it's datelined to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The U.S. Department of Justice says the Iowa Department of Human Services and staff at the Glenwood Resource Center violated residents' 14th Amendment rights by providing inadequate care and experimenting on them without their knowledge or consent. Iowa operates Glenwood in a manner that has subjected residents to unreasonable harm and risk of harm in violation of their 14th Amendment rights by exposing them to uncontrolled and unsupervised physical and behavioral experimentation, inadequate physical and behavioral health, and inadequate protections from harm, including deficient safety and oversight mechanisms, according to the 63-page report DHS released in late December. The 14th Amendment says the government can't deprive any American of life, liberty, or property without due process. The DOJ continues to investigate whether Glenwood has violated the Americans with Disabilities Act at the facility in western Iowa. The federal probe, which started in 2019, resulted in the firing of Jerry Ray as superintendent. Former residents have alleged in a federal lawsuit that Ray used residents in sexual arousal experiments without their permission. The report includes 4 pages of remedies that the Justice Department says it will work with the DHS to implement. The DHS issued the following statement. We spoke with our federal partners and continue to work with them on the best path forward to ensure we provide the best care to those we serve. The department is in the process of reviewing these findings. We will continue discussions with our legal counsel and the DOJ. We have been in a collaborative role in this process from day one. As we are still in legal conversations related to the matter, we do not have any further comment to provide at this time, just as we have this entire past year. We will continue to keep all of our stakeholders updated, including the families of our residents, legislators, and the public. Our highest priority is the care and well-being of those we serve. Our next story, CDC adds Down syndrome to COVID-19 increased risk list. This story by Michelle Diament. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is acknowledging for the first time that COVID-19 poses an especially high risk for people with Down syndrome. The federal agency updated its list of conditions that carry an increased risk of severe illness from the virus that causes COVID-19 in late December to include Down syndrome. Severe illness from COVID-19 is defined as hospitalization, admission to the ICU, intubation, and mechanical ventilation or death, the CDC said. That makes Down syndrome one of a dozen conditions, including cancer, chronic kidney disease, obesity, and pregnancy, that the CDC specifically warns have been linked to an increased risk from the virus. The agency also maintains a separate list of conditions that might be at an increased risk for several or for severe illness from the virus that causes COVID-19. We are learning more about COVID-19 every day, the CDC indicated. The below list of underlying medical conditions is not exhaustive and only includes conditions with sufficient evidence to draw conclusions. It is a living document that may be updated at any time, subject to potentially rapid change as the science evolves. The CDC said that the addition of Down syndrome to the increased risk list came in response to recent data. People with a chromosomal disorder should talk to their health care provider about their individual risk in light of their medical history and the situation in their community, the agency said. Research published in the fall that was based on a review of medical records for 8.26 million adults in England found that people with Down syndrome were 4 times more likely than others to be hospitalized due to COVID-19 and 10 times more likely to die from the virus. A handful of other studies in recent months have provided additional evidence that individuals with Down syndrome and other developmental disabilities face a higher risk of death from COVID-19. As a result, disability advocates have been pushing states to prioritize people with developmental disabilities in their vaccine distribution plans. But a December report from the American Network of Community Options and Resources, or ANCOR, which represents disability service providers across the nation, found that only 10 states had specifically addressed those with developmental disabilities in their plans. The next article, written by Kyle Arnold of the Dallas Morning News, entitled Airlines Crackdown on Service Animals. American Airlines says it will no longer allow emotional support animals and other pets on its planes that don't meet strict service animal requirements for individuals with disabilities. The change was made after more lenient policies had frustrated flight attendants, disability support groups, and airlines themselves. The Fort Worth-based airline will start the stricter requirements for pets in the cabin on January 11th, which means it's already started, and will soon require anyone traveling with a service animal to complete a federal form 2 days in advance. The change comes after the U.S. Department of Transportation tightened rules for service animals in December, ending years of complaints from passengers and crew members about travelers flaunting service animal rules to fly with pets for free. Airlines are often left with little choice as federal law allows service animals for people with disabilities, but had given little guidance on what a disability was or what kind of animals were appropriate. Now the new rule says a service animal is a dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability, and that it no longer considers an emotional support animal to be a service animal. Trained psychiatric service animals will still be permitted. American Airlines follows Alaska Airlines, which said last week that it will ban the practice of transporting emotional support animals starting January 11th as well. Americans will still allow customers to transport small pets under 20 pounds in an approved carrier, but those animals will no longer be allowed to sit on the customer's laps during the flights. The Association of Professional Flight Attendants, the Union for Americans Flight Attendants, had complained that emotional support animals were dangerous and unfair. The union said flight attendants had been bitten and snarled at by untrained animals. In an era when personal space on the aircraft is at an all-time minimum, there is not adequate room for animals that are not specifically trained and certified to assist their handler, said a statement from APFA President Julie Hedrick when the DOT passed its rule. More and more animals are encroaching on the personal space and comfort of other passengers. Over the years, passengers claimed exotic pets such as peacocks, kangaroos, and snakes are emotional support animals. American and other airlines have moved recently to restrict more powerful dog breeds and other animals from access to flying with customers. Travelers could purchase certifications on the internet for as little as $50, saying that they needed an emotional support animal for issues such as anxiety. Veterans groups, disability advocates, and flight attendants unions all lobbied DOT to amend its rules to allow airlines to take a stricter stance. Our team is motivated by a purpose to care for people on life's journey, and we believe these policy changes will improve our ability to do just that, said a statement from Jessica Tyler, America's President of Cargo and Vice President of Airport Excellence. We're confident this approach will enable us to better serve our customers, particularly those with disabilities who travel with service animals, and better protect our team members at the airport and on the aircraft. The next article, newborn screening may contain autism clues, this written by Sean Heasley. A simple routine test may be able to detect autism in newborn children, researchers say. Tests regularly given to newborns to screen for hearing loss could also offer clues about whether they are on the spectrum, according to a new study. The tests measure a child's auditory brainstem response, or ABR, to determine how the inner ear and brain react to sounds. For the study, researchers looked at almost 140,000 auditory recordings from children born in Florida and matched them with the state's educational records. They found the kids later diagnosed with autism showed slower brain responses during the infant hearing tests. We're not at the point just yet where we're telling clinicians to use ABR testing as a determinant for autism in babies, said Elizabeth Simpson, an associate professor at the University of Miami, who worked on the study published recently in the journal Autism Research. But we are saying that the study presents a promising direction how ABR testing can be used as a method for precise autism detection at birth. Simpson noted that children with autism may process sound differently even if their hearing is normal, so researchers are considering how adding more layers to the auditory screening could better pick up on a child's risk for autism and other developmental issues. the importance for diagnosing autism early during infant and child development, when interventions can have the most impact, cannot be overstated, said Oren Mirren, a research associate at Harvard Medical School who led the study. Any additional tool that could clarify diagnostic clues would be invaluable in that regard. The next article, written by Michelle Diament, and it's entitled Program Helping People Leave Institutions Renewed After Years in Limbo. Following years of uncertainty, federal lawmakers are giving new life to a popular Medicaid program that moves people with disabilities from institutions into the community. Money Follows the Person has been renewed for 3 years under legislation approved in late December. The Medicaid program gives states extra funds to provide employment, housing, and other services to help people transition from nursing homes and other institutions to homes in the community. The development caps off a tumultuous few years for the program. Money Follows a Person officially expired in 2016, and Congress has approved 8 short-term extensions, including one as brief as 7 days, in order to keep it alive since then. However, the uncertainty led many states to stop making transitions and shutter their programs as money ran out. The renewal, which came as a part of a broader government spending bill, should bring some stability to the effort by committing $450 million annually to the program through September 2023. What's more, lawmakers included tweaks to allow all states to participate and to shorten the amount of time a person would have to stay at an institution before they qualify to transition to the community from 90 days to 60 days, according to Nicole Jorwick, Senior Director of Public Policy at the ARC. While we were pushing for permanence, 3 years of funding available to all states, not just those with existing programs, will be very helpful in the face of the pandemic to move people with disabilities out of large congregate settings like nursing homes and institutions and back into their homes and communities, Jorwick said. A recent report from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services indicates that between 2008 and 2019, Money Follows the Person helped 102,000 people leave institutions for community-based settings. In addition to renewing Money Follows the Person, the federal spending bill also increased funding for special education by $186 million, allocated $25 million extra for housing for people with disabilities, and added $35 million for the administration on community living, among other changes for the 2021 fiscal year. Our next story, virtual learning comes with added curve for special ed students. This article written by Mara Keecher of the Star Tribune and is datelined out of Minneapolis. Lisa Juliar was resolved when distance learning began last spring. She'd do whatever she could to offer her son the kind of one-on-one assistance he'd been getting at school. But even with her help, Cooper, a senior at Mounds View High School, has struggled mightily with distance learning. He has a rare chromosomal condition called cri du chat that affects his speech and language, and he's had trouble expressing himself during Zoom classes. He sometimes grows so frustrated he starts screaming, grabbing at his mother's hair, and even slamming the laptop shut. These are not behaviors he had in school, Julia said. It's not that the teachers aren't doing as much as they can, but distance learning just isn't working for my son. The pandemic school year that has frustrated so many is proving almost impossible for many of Minnesota's 148,000 special education students. Despite the creativity of teachers working to engage students online, the success of distance learning for special education students often hinges on the child's independence or parents' assistance throughout the school day. Teachers and aides are overwhelmed with paperwork for changing learning models and are finding it more difficult to virtually assess students' moods and needs. In an executive order in November, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz urged school districts to prioritize in-person instruction for students with disabilities, and the state's Safe Learning Plan allows schools to offer in-school support to special education students if it's safe to do so, even if the district is in distance learning. But it's up to districts to determine whether to offer one-on-one in-person support in the home. Still, there are success stories. Distance learning has pushed some students with disabilities to find new ways to communicate their needs, and parents are forming stronger partnerships with special education staff. That's certainly a lot of frustration, but also so many dedicated parents and people at the schools making sure these students are succeeding, said Darren Cordy, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Education. And there may be change ahead. Walz announced last month that Minnesota elementary schools can open for full in-person instruction starting January 18th if they meet safety requirements. The ever-shifting school year has required teachers and families to create individualized education programs for distance, hybrid, and in-person learning. As Tracy DeLoff, a middle school special education teacher in the New London Spicer School District in central Minnesota, put it, the amount of paperwork right now in dealing with this pandemic in special education is insurmountable. On a recent school day, David Perry documented every time his 13-year-old son had trouble with distance learning. Nico has Down syndrome and autism and communicates mostly nonverbally. Perry listened in and noted the times Nico stopped engaging or communicated in a way that didn't translate over the screen. By afternoon, his tally topped 100. We as parents are pushed to talk about the things my son can't do, and that's just brutal, Perry said. It's true he can't type a password into the computer or open an email to get a Zoom link. That only works if there's someone actually in the room with him, if he has an aide, or if I quit my job. At the start of the month, the Perry family hired Nico's personal care assistant to also help him with distance learning in the Mounds View District, which isn't currently contracting with providers for in-home services. Partnering with third-party contractors can introduce issues of accountability and concerns about rate of pay and qualifications, said Colin Sokolowski, a spokesman for Mounds View Schools. The district will evaluate the option throughout the pandemic and is focused on bringing students back as quickly and safely as possible, he said. I just want my son educated. That is really my driving force, Perry said. Mounds View Schools is beginning to open school buildings this month to some students, including Nico and Cooper, for in-person help with online learning 4 days a week. But Perry worries about that fifth day of the school week, as well as the potential COVID-19 exposure. Julia is concerned about Cooper's future. At 19, he is to receive job readiness training to help special education students transition into adulthood. But that's all online, too. We're going to have a whole group of kids who can't just bounce back from this, he said. Losing in these months is so much bigger for them. Switching from in-person to remote learning and back again has been tough on students who are used to routines, said Erica Friesen-Zeze, who works with students in District 287. It's a specialized district that serves West Metro students with complex learning and behavioral needs. When they were in person, staff absences due to quarantine or illness meant students were constantly working with unfamiliar people. COVID-19 safety measures meant students couldn't use shared spaces that were usually a part of their day, like the gym or the school library. Frizan Zeze is glad many of her students have parents at home with them, helping them to keep them on track, but it's still often an uphill battle to keep everyone focused. Students with disabilities are more successful with consistency, she said. Closing and opening in-person remote changes, it's hard for them. Despite the difficulties, distance learning for special education has brought about some unexpected benefits. Brian Rappi, a special education teacher at Nicolet Middle School in Burnsville, has spent the school year working with students who opted for the district's full-time distance learning option. He has noticed students are more willing to speak up when they need assistance. Tara Tuchel, a speech-language pathologist in Stillwater Schools, has noticed the same thing, even among the students who can have trouble with verbal language. Virtual learning has also strengthened the relationships she has with parents and meant more individualized strategies, he said. Creating fun virtual activities takes more time and problem solving, but it's rewarding to see it work, Tuchel said. Susan Herline, the mother of a six-year-old at Stillwater's Rutherford Elementary, said her daughter's teachers have taught her as well. They've helped us learn how to be better parents, Herline said. Our daughter is nonverbal, so she couldn't come home to tell me how her day was, but now I can actually see how she learns. Next article written by Phil Galewitz of the Calzer Health News, and it's entitled, Trump Administration Approves First Medicaid Block Grant. With just a few days left in power, the Trump administration a week ago approved a radically different Medicaid financing system in Tennessee that for the first time would give the state broader authority in running the health insurance program for the poor in exchange for capping its annual federal funding. The approval is a 10-year experiment. Instead of the open-ended federal funding that rises with higher enrollment and health costs, Tennessee will instead get an annual block grant. The approach has been pushed for decades by conservatives who say states too often chafe under strict federal guidelines about enrollment and coverage and find ways to provide care more efficiently. But under the agreement, Tennessee's annual funding cap will increase if enrollment grows. What's different is that unlike other states, federal Medicaid funding in Tennessee won't automatically keep up with rising per-person Medicaid expenses. The approval, however, faces an uncertain future because the incoming Biden administration is likely to oppose such a move. But to unravel it, officials would need to set up a review that includes a public hearing. Meanwhile, the changes in Tennessee will take months to implement because they need final legislative approval, and state officials must negotiate quality of care targets with the administration. TennCare, the state's Medicaid program, said the block grant system would give it unprecedented flexibility to decide who is covered and what services it will pay for. Under the agreement, TennCare will have a specified spending cap based on historical spending, inflation, and predicted future enrollment changes. If the state can operate the program at a lower cost than the cap and maintain or improve quality, the state then shares in the savings. Trump administration officials say the approach adds incentive for the state to save money, unlike the current system in which increased state spending is matched with more federal dollars. If Medicaid enrollment grows, the state can secure additional federal funding. If enrollment drops, it will get less money. This groundbreaking waiver puts guardrails in place to ensure appropriate oversight and protections for beneficiaries, while also creating incentives for states to manage costs while holding them accountable for improving access, quality, and health outcomes, said Seema Verma, administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It's no exaggeration to say that this carefully crafted demonstration could be a national model moving forward. Opponents, including most advocates for low-income Americans, say the approach will threaten care for the 1.4 million people on TennCare, who include children, pregnant women, and people with disabilities. Federal funding covers two-thirds of the cost of the program. Michelle Johnson, executive director of the Tennessee Justice Center, said the block grant approval is a step backward for the state's Medicare program. No other state has sought a block grant, and for good reason. It gives state officials a blank check and creates financial incentives to cut health care to vulnerable families, she said. The agreement is different from traditional block grants championed by conservatives since it allows Tennessee to get more federal funding to keep up with enrollment growth. In addition, while the state is given flexibility to increase benefits, it can't cut them on its own. Democrats have fought back a block grant Medicaid proposal since the Reagan administration, and most recently in 2018, as part of the Republicans' failed effort to repeal and replace major parts of the Affordable Care Act. Even some key Republicans oppose the idea because it would cut billions in funding to states, making it harder to help the poor. Implementing block grants via an executive branch action rather than getting Congress to amend Medicaid law is also likely to be met with court challenges. This is an illegal move that could threaten access to health care for vulnerable people in the middle of a pandemic. U.S. Representative Frank Pallone, Democrat of New Jersey, chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, posted on his Twitter account, "I'm hopeful the Biden administration will move quickly to roll back this harmful policy as soon as possible." The block grant approval comes as Medicaid enrollment is at its highest ever level. More than 76 million Americans are covered by the state federal health program, a million more than when the Trump administration took charge in 2017. Enrollment has jumped by more than $5 million in the past year as the economy slumped with the pandemic. Medicaid, part of President Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society Initiative of the 1960s, is an entitlement program in which the government pays each state a certain percentage of the cost of care for anyone eligible for the health coverage. As a result, the more money states spend on Medicaid, the more they get from Washington. Under the approved demonstration, CMS will work with Tennessee to set spending targets that will increase at a fixed amount each year. The plan includes a safety valve to increase federal funding due to unexpected increases in enrollment. Tennessee is committed to maintaining coverage for eligible beneficiaries and existing services. In exchange for taking on this financing approach, the state will receive a range of operating flexibilities from the federal government, as well as up to 55% of the savings generated on an annual basis when spending falls below the aggregate spending cap and the state meets certain quality targets yet to be determined. The state can spend that money on various health programs for residents, including areas that Medicaid funding typically doesn't cover, such as improving transportation and education and employment services for enrollees. Tennessee is one of 12 states that have not approved expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, leaving tens of thousands of working adults without health insurance. The block grant is just another example of putting politics ahead of health care during this pandemic, said Johnson of the Tennessee Justice Center. Now is absolutely not the time to waste our energy and resources limiting who can access health care. Well, that is all the time we have for today. This has been Kevin with Able Living. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Center Solutions Podcast, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
West Campus Testing Site extends hours. Midland Health has received funding from the city that will allow extended hours for COVID-19 testing at Midland Memorial Hospital, West Campus. The testing site will operate 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. weekdays and 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturdays. Anyone who has been exposed or is symptomatic can call 68 Nurse 686-8773 to make an appointment at the drive-thru testing site. The test is free for those who are scheduled. Insurance information will be collected from those who are insured, according to the release.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades.
As we've pointed out several times, you do things when you're blind. Many times you do them the same way a sighted person would. A drill is a drill is a drill. A saw is a saw. And you just need to remember, don't get your fingers in it and push the board through it.
You want to make sure that your structure will support this.
We're going to talk about an email that we've gotten about a stove ignition problem.
Assuming that you're blind, John, and you can't read a voltmeter, what do you want to do there?
Most of the new ones in the high scale reading, it'll make a buzz and all.
We're going to talk about installing a micro hood. This is a combination microwave and vent hood.
And we've started drinking early. No, I'm not only kidding.
The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Wasn't me who changed, but you. And now you've gone away. Don't you see that now you've gone, and I'm left here on my own, that I have to follow you.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 42 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 11 a.m.
Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. This week's presidential inauguration included several milestones for women. In today's show, I will share some of those stories with you, beginning with CNBC. Kamala Debbie Harris is sworn in as the country's first female, black, Asian American vice president. By Hannah Miao. Kamala Debbie Harris was sworn in Wednesday as the nation's first female, black, and South Asian American vice president. She took her oath moments before Joe Biden was set to be sworn in as the nation's 46th president. Sonia Sotomayor, America's first Latina Supreme Court justice, administered the vice presidential oath of office to Harris. Harris and Biden on Inauguration Day inherited a country facing the COVID crisis, an economic downturn, and demands for racial justice. A daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, Harris has made history throughout her career. As a U.S. Senator for California, Harris, 56, was the second black woman and first South Asian American to serve in the upper chamber. Before her Senate tenure, Harris was the first female, black, and South Asian American Attorney General of California.